Well, they decided to have a talk where they did the, we tried to sum up the upshot of the meeting and decide what to take away from it, if anything, and that was too much for one person, so, and besides, I'll be biased. I'm sure I'll be biased. So I tried to recruit a few henchmen to give more balancing out views. Well, the meeting was great fun. We had a mascot. We had a mantra. Us physicists finally got that into our head. I at least did. But really, on a little bit more serious note, it's clear how we would answer these two questions of, did the meeting work? Was it worthwhile? Did it give us some kind of a greater unity in our knowledge of this kind of stuff? And did it give us new ways to think about things? And for my purpose, the answer is a resounding yes, that it really worked, and I learned a huge amount, and I feel grateful to Bill Gelbart and Phil Pincus and Adrian, and maybe this is a point we should thank them. Okay, so it worked. But so let me launch into what is of course going to be a kind of biased view, and hopefully will be a little bit of a provocative view with some well-chosen mistakes. It seemed to me there was one dominant thing that was the preoccupation of the meeting, and really to a good degree a preoccupation of the program, as I understand what people have been doing, and that is this glue business. To what extent can some kind of a medium, and we're talking about ions as our medium, serve as a glue between two objects? And, you know, lots of times we have this glue effect. It's more general than ions. The philosophy is that the medium attracts one of the objects, it attracts also the other one, and the objects end up being together when they wouldn't want to otherwise. The big subtle issue of this one is if the glue is ions and the objects are charged, can the glue not only attract them together, but attract them strong enough to overcome their intrinsic dislike for each other, their Coulomb repulsion? And when does it overcome the Coulomb repulsion? And the kind of driving force behind the whole thing is to kind of answer that question in a general framework and say, on a general grounds, when you could do it, not only for the simple ions which have been treated for many years, but for all these sexy soft matter ions which may be variable in size, way above the simple ions, variable in shape, and all these are supposed to be considered rigid, but then on top of that, we've spoken of many kinds of deformable ions. Question is, when can each of these serve as glue, and when can they be glued? So that's the thing I want to emphasize. And I do think some kind of consensus about this has kind of emerged from this meeting, if not before. And put this one over here. The place to start with this is where the meeting did start with this, is the simplest form of this gluing phenomenon, where you just have a simple ionic solution. That is, when do simple ions act as glue or just for one another? And that's a useful way to introduce, you know, the parameters that would characterize what these ions are like and their potential to serve as glue. First of all, there's some medium, they have a density, and they have a radius. So the way to characterize the density is just in terms of the volume fraction, with a maximum up here when you have nothing else in your liquid. Separately from that, you have to say how strongly they interact. The glue things interact among themselves, and that's this famous Bjerrum length. To say the temperature is to say 1 over the Bjerrum length. So this Bjerrum length inverse scale is essentially a temperature scale with hot on the top and cold on the bottom. And then we can characterize how these small ions act in some ways by a couple of lines on this scale. What you really need to know is when you should consider it weak and when you should consider it strong. And up above here, the hot side, is when you should consider it weak. And here, the mutual interaction between two adjacent ions is very, very small. And simple, almost ideal gas pictures should work. That's the famous Boltzmann-Poisson picture, in which one of these ions cannot even see the others except through its average electrostatic potential averaged over a pretty large scale. On that scale, everybody, this is a consensus, I think, from our meeting, there's no particularly liquid structure to worry about. It's only when you get down below this line, and indeed get down to this blue line, that the liquid structure starts to appear. This is the line on which particles that are a typical nearest neighbor distance apart feel each other with an energy of kT. So one thing we've learned about this simple ionic solution is that there's a privileged type of gluing, these dimers. And so there's a molecular equilibrium line where the dimers would dissociate. And Michael Fischer showed us that just because of prefactors, the dimers are unexpectedly favored. So there's an interaction between this dimer association and the strong boundary between strong and weak interaction of the individual ions, going from an ideal gas, by the way, to all the way to an ionic crystal, Boris's Wigner crystal that he told us all about. You can have something, some kind of cooperative phenomenon between an ideal gas and an ionic crystal. You can have condensation, as we saw by the three theory talks of Lesser and Michael Fischer and George Stell. I guess one of my provocative points, I think that this ought to be where that condensation sets in. But in any case, this characterizes what our basic glue does. And what has emerged from the meeting is that you're always in a certain region of this diagram when you have the gluing effect. You're on this side of on this side where the interaction of two neighboring glue guys is of order kT. The elementary objects that are supposed to make up the glue are interacting with energy kT for most of the complexes we've considered. The simplest one being a salt bridge here. And these more macroscopic things made out of bigger degrees of freedom are kind of the moral equivalent of a salt bridge. They're rigid objects, each of which has an energy of interaction with its neighbors of the same kind or other kind that's worth kT or on the scale of kT, be they Cirrus's DNA and lipid complexes or Neely Dan's little micelles and vesicles, or these rigidly held together crystals or near crystals of DNA complexes. It seemed like we have concluded that in all these, the elementary pieces have kT. And so conceptually, this is not a big puzzle. It's no more puzzling than a salt bridge. That's what I'd like to put forward for your attacks. Now, there's another thing that seemed to be a kind of universal concomitant. Whenever we got this gluing effect, we always had something else. And what else we had was large heterogeneity of charge. In the ionic solution, there were you could characterize this, if you look across a piece of the solution, take a snapshot of it, you could characterize it by an average ionic strength and by a fluctuation of charge, delta Q. And you didn't get any action unless delta Q got to be the same size as Q in that ionic system. And, you know, everything I could think of in the whole meeting had the same property. You have to have delta Q on the order of Q, whether it be some little heterogeneously charged pieces, if you get them close enough together so that their variability of charge looks like more important than their overall charge, well, that's when you get like ions to attract. And this is the kind of situation, Bill, when you get the phenomenon of overcharging. I think overcharging, which has been discussed greatly in the program, is kind of the cousin or the mirror image of this phenomenon of when can like charges attract. They can do it if they're sufficiently heterogeneous. And we saw a jillion more examples. That poster in the back that with that student of Sam Safran's, I tried to remember the name. What? Dima Lutovsky. It showed this in the context of parallel plates with deformable ions on them. And you can, if the counter ions are sufficiently uniform, you can get the deformable ions over here, the red ones, to get complementary heterogeneity so that there's a net attraction. Likewise, Andrea showed you could have this happening with rod-like molecules too. So the question is, now I want to point to that green question mark. Is that your question about, Michael?
Can you explain what the input Q and delta Q?
Yes. I look in some region of my system and I look at the amount by which the charge in my region is different from the average, and I call that delta Q. And then I look at now delta Q can only get so big. If I would take all the pluses away altogether, this delta Q would get how big? It would be as big as Q bar. So that's delta Q equal to Q bar is a measure of large heterogeneity. Was that your question? You say, what did I mean by delta Q and Q bar? That's what I mean. So
what do you mean by Q bar?
It's not the average charge. Q bar would not be the average charge, right?
No, but everybody has charges that came in integrals of 1, 2, or 3.
Yes.
Microscopic charges.
Yes.
Would then either spread out, like in Bosse-Boltzmann, or more realistically located over a few angstroms. So
yes.
I'm not quite sure if your Q bar is always some multiple of a protonic charge, let's say, or something smaller. So
no.
Some of the cases you're thinking about in electronic.
Well, look at this. What I'm talking about is I'm kind of got 100% modulation or a finite fraction of modulation of this red charge. It's bigger over here than it is over here by a healthy factor, like not epsilon, not arbitrarily small, but you know, let's say 30% for starters. Okay. Now look. Now. Yes.
So for gluing polyamphalized, you don't need the delta Q can be a smaller square root of Q, and the polyamphalized glue together. That's the kind of cadaver.
If you take a big enough denominator, you can have that. I think we should come back and discuss that. I'm off balance for the moment. I think we should come back and talk about that because I think you may have found a counterexample and I'm just not fast enough on my feet. But
No, the bilength is the bilength is more than the chain. As soon as the bilength becomes more than the chain, quantum collides go together and collapse.
But that's because they are entropy small fractions, not the reason.
Well, why does that? I mean, I'm trying to be as general as that. I'm not trying to say that I would rule out such a case. Okay, but look at this. This deals with a point that Boris has come emphasized again and again, and I'm not sure who's right. If I'm at this stage where delta Q is big enough to make an attraction, do I have to be at the stage where I'm below this line and each one of my glue particles, each one of my ions, is strongly interacting with its nearest neighbor? Do I have to be there? I think, where's Boris? He's gone. But I think he would say yes. And I just was not thinking fast enough last night to be sure about this. If I don't think everybody here in this audience has settled with this question, and this is an important question. Do you have to have strong interaction with your neighbors? I have a feeling that in these two cases, it ends up being that you do. I think it's kind of inevitable. So even these things are pretty much the moral equivalent of a salt bridge. Okay. Now, I wanted to say one more slide. When you want to sum up a meeting, you want to say, where do you go from here? Where do we stand now? What new direction does this bring up? And to me, the thing that had the biggest impact was Alexander Grossberg's question at the beginning. He wants to know, when will a soft matter thing get frozen? So he was applying it to polyamphalites, I guess, but all of the complexes we're talking about, that's a burning issue. That is a real basic issue, I think, that I don't think has been settled, and I don't think gets settled by settling this issue either. If we would look, but we do have the beginnings of an answer to it. I remember I asked Mark Stevens, who had this kind of DNA complex, except his didn't turn around in a loop. Are the chains frozen in there or liquid? He said, oh, don't worry, they're liquid. But what I want to point out from this is, by our previous arguments, they're within fighting distance of being frozen. The elementary units in there are interacting rather strongly.
But I think that's a little bit of a fake question. That's like asking, is the glass a solid or a liquid?
No, I don't.
I think it's the moral equivalent of that.
No, I think it's the moral equivalent. Can you have a soft glass? Can you have a glass that has a 1% volume fraction? So I think it might be. No, here's the deal. I think already taking for granted that a chain and a polymer in here would be hard to move locally, and so it'd be kind of like a glass and. It would be, maybe it would flow eventually, but it would have a big activated mobility, and it's more like a solid. But what Mark really said was that the chains can diffuse along here just fine. So it seems that the evidence at this moment is that the formation of one of these very well-defined complexes does, even though the interaction at the local scale has to be big, it doesn't have to be so big to make what Boris called a Wigner crystal and freeze everything. There can be plenty of liquid mobility. But still, I think the fact they're strongly interacting means they're going to have an interesting rheology. Even if they are, we do come down on the side that they're often liquid, what's going to happen to these when we pull on them is going to be an interesting point. And there's a point that didn't really get covered very much until the last couple of talks in this meeting. Nothing about dynamics, just structure. But that we have this whole world, now that we've kind of basically understand the structure, we have all these neat questions to ask about the dynamics, how the stress relaxes, and a lot of questions about the pathway to assembling these objects. And distorting them and seeing how they recover. And then, so there is a direction to my mind that opens up. And then there's a big, big puzzle that has gotten nothing but more acute, nothing but more intense as the week unfolds. And it's this pesky David Greer experiment, where he has these colloids sitting ridiculously far apart and insisting on liking each other nevertheless. Here we know, as has been emphasized a jillion times, we're up in this corner of the diagram as far as the glue is concerned. It's the most passive and easy to model and describe. We can be most sure about this of any place else on the diagram, and indeed very sure.
So why are we up there? I mean, the density wasn't all that low. I mean, they were all within 2 or 3. If
no,
the pictures meant what they said, they were all much closer together than a diameter, so I put them over on the right-hand side.
No, this is David's colloid. No, this is the... I kind of stare at David's view graphs, and this isn't a bad representation. Right, David?
That's right. That's pretty much the scale.
There's, let's say, 700 ions in this whole micron volume. You know, 1,400 ions. It's dilute.
About the little ions. I'm looking at the macro ions and how close they are to the surface, and the, when you have the little crystal lights and so on, you put one up the end and move things around.
They're a couple of diameters away from each other, and they're a couple of diameters away from the surface.
That's correct, but a couple of diameters gets one, since you have a log scale there, gets one much more over to the right-hand side than the left.
No, but okay, what Michael is saying is that the mutual energy between these two in magnitude is potentially of a large scale. But that's not what I'm talking about here. What our issue is here is what are the properties of these little blue dots? That's the glue. So what do we have to do to understand the glue once we have fixed the positions of these red things? Yeah, and the other thing is, in Boltzmann-Poisson, which we certainly agree is a decent way to speak of these blue dots, the interaction energy is, whether it be attractive or repulsive, is only of the order of KT. They're several screening lengths away from each other. Well,
if we believe Poisson-Boltzmann is sufficient, well, look, you drew the surface in there.
I drew the surface happily.
Yeah. And I mean, that was beautifully explained by David Greer as an important ingredient. And then he also explained that if I actually had a crystal surface there with the same stuff, that also worked.
Correct.
It seems to me he demonstrated very beautifully that this is not a two body effect. So the extra question I would add to you. Which, you know, you can take it various ways. If I start with two protons, they repel very strongly. If I put a couple of electrons, one electron, I have hydrogen, that forms a very nice molecule. Okay. Now you can say, all right, we sort of understand that, and, you know, there are all sorts of things about the electrons in between. It's non-obvious, and if I form helium, then the interactions between the heliums are very, very weak. And in fact, can be essentially repulsive. The latest atomic physics evidence is that heliums are not attractive, okay, when you really do it. And yet helium condenses. Furthermore, it turns out it doesn't condense into at low temperatures into a liquid, but into a superfluid. So there are other subtleties, and it seems to me that when one's loosely talked about fluctuations here, one should rather talk about entropy, which is, you know, how you realize fluctuations. And the entropy is a very subtle effect, and we know many phases which are very hard to understand. If I think of the high temperature superconductors, in some sense I form the objects that are going to both condense before I get there. If I think of the low temperature BCS superconductors, the pairs come into existence practically coincident with the whole thing condensing. And so I think, I mean, those are very hard problems, but they're much easier still than these. And I think it's that aspect that's rather hard for us to bring in here. So you can rephrase it another way around. When is an effective pair interaction enough to tell me about the condensation? And since everything David said showed that you needed something else there beyond the pairs, it seems to me that's the direction he pointed.
Okay. I kind of disagree with that, but I don't want to get it sidetrack the discussion. I think I can say it quick. I think David's experiment is able to demonstrate the stuff he's talking about, the attraction, by holding his things that he wants to know that about that would phase separate at fixed positions. They could be at a lattice, or they could be held in place near this surface, like this. So we don't have to worry about their entropy. They don't have any entropy. We've fixed their positions. We have to worry about some entropy, but it's this entropy we know all about. And we certainly have to, it's, like you say, it's not a two-body interaction because this wall is supposed to be doing something. But I think it is a big and deeper and stranger puzzle. And that's what I want to say. And now I would like to turn the floor over to Robin. I'll turn the stick over to you, too.
Well, that's a
I'll turn the microphone over and turn too. Yes.
So when Tom asked me last night whether I wanted to comment about sort of the biology side, I told Tom that I felt that I was the least qualified person, probably there Victor Bloomfield, as Adrian Persigian. Nevertheless, he insists I'm going to make a fool of myself, and he wanted me to comment on those possible areas of research which could be inspired by this wonderful conference and where I would like to see an answer. Now, these things are terribly subjective, and I remember I never pay any attention when other senior scientists tell me what to do, so you probably shouldn't pay any attention to this. I basically decided to give you a list of the notes which I made during the conference of various questions I came across, which I would like to see answered. Now, like Tom already mentioned, a lot of the speakers have addressed the question of DNA-DNA interaction and the condensation. There have been broadly two classes of theories, the Digne crystallization, where you such as emphasized by Sergei, by Lakin and by Slowski, where you emphasize the DNA architecture, chemical association, and ion size, and crystallization, condensation start, just like Tom says, when typical electrostatic energies become bigger than KT. We have heard different viewpoints, originally inspired, I think, by Ozawa, where you look at fluctuation correction systematically around Poisson-Boltzmann theory, and Niran Kadar talked about, and there seem to be two conflicting descriptions on the moment of how DNA condensation comes about. I myself have been sort of associated with this side, but it is very clear that there are two quite different descriptions, and they are really different because in Niran's description yesterday, you heard there was absolutely no detail whatsoever. It was perfectly universal. But in Sergei Lakin's description, all the small details mattered. Now, I would like to see, of course, a kind of theory which can cover both ranges, sort of like in Tom's view graph, where you go from the high-temperature region systematically to the low-temperature region. Here, thermal fluctuations seem to destroy the attraction. Here, thermal fluctuations magically help the attraction. I don't understand it, and I would like to know the answer. But
come on, you know the answer.
Speak up. I don't mean to say that there is a phase transition between them. One emphasizes one aspect and the other emphasizes another aspect. But what you'd like to see is one theory which can go, which in one limit reproduces systematic expansion around Poisson-Boltzmann, and another theory shows you a nice Wigner crystal. Right. Surely.
But
Actually, if you take Mehran's expression, the attraction doesn't get stronger at low temperatures. They're really not quite the same. I do not agree with you, Andrea, in that respect. And in fact, the same in Ozawa's description. If you take his attractive force, it becomes very small at low temperatures, Andrea. But I want to turn actually to the question, to what extent does it help us to understand DNA condensation? Now, the first thing I was wondering is, well, a lot of experiments are done by biologists on DNA condensation, which is circular. Now, how does circular DNA collapse? Well, if you want to do it and you play with a string, well, the first thing you would do is you kind of twist it up. And then you fold it and thereby reduce the radius by something like a factor of 2. And then you repeat it and you repeat it and you repeat it, right? That's how you can make a torus out of a large ring. Now, you can bias that process a little bit by cutting this string here and twisting it up. Let's say you say that then the linking number has been changed by 1. Then the new ground state, elastic ground state, rather than a circle, becomes the figure 8, which is basically the one you'd create here when you start to collapse. And then you have to repeat it. So in other words, it seems that if you start with a linking number 1, it is easier to collapse a chain than if you start with a linking number 0, because you don't have to pay this extra twisting energy price, because this is already the ground state. And you can take linking number 2 and 3 and 4. Now, as a matter of fact, that is how bacteria do go about condensation. They both produce supercoiling when they want to condense the DNA and have polyvalent ions for condensation. So I would like to see somebody who could do this, a good condensation theory, at the same time as allowing for supercoiling. Okay? Then there is the question of the dynamics. Mark Stevens has referred to that already. We have a beam field description, a la Manning, of counter-ion condensation. If you take Sergei Lakin's nice picture, then these ions spend most of the time perhaps in the major groove. On occasion, one goes on and one goes off. Now, what is the dynamics of this problem? Well, actually, this is like a one-dimensional spiral conductor, an ionic conductor, but it's an ionic conductor with vacancies, because every now and then an ion will come on and off. Now, it turns out that in the 70s, Alexander and Orbach and a whole row of people were very concerned about the dynamics of this type of problem. It's called ionic conductors, and they behave rather odd because of the very large Coulomb propulsion between them. They have power laws in their frequency-dependent dielectric constant. In this particular case, you wouldn't have just a simple dielectric constant, but rather a dielectric tensor, which should reflect the symmetry of the DNA spiral. And I'll tell you in a moment why I think it would be very nice to know this particular tensor. But it is not just an ionic conductor, because it has these vacancies. It has a finite concentration of vacancies corresponding to the degree of Manning condensation. So what is the dynamics if I put the electrical field in this direction? I also can put, of course, an electrical field in this direction. And I try to move these ions around so they kind of hum in this spiral. What is the transport properties of that? I would like to know the answer. And then, this is now the typical physicist view of DNA, which is that it's a negatively charged rod. This is the most primitive one, which I, of course, use. It's a negatively charged rod with positively charged ions. And then condensation is if you have low concentration of dipoles, or, divalent ions, which are still monopoles. If you work a little bit better, you make it into a spiral, like, again, Sergei did. Still, this is the basic idea. If you ask about salt concentration, well, maybe a physicist will tell you you really should do this with about 0.1 to 1 molar of salt. The condensation starts if you have typically millimolar amount of trivalent ions for DNA. For other biopolymers, you didn't hear much about them, it can be divalent. So very small amounts of polyvalent ions are added to trigger the condensation, the beautiful pioneering experiments by Victor Bloomfield. Now, Dr. Muthukumar already tells you that that is a little bit of a caricature. Here's a couple of pictures from a very nice book called The Machinery of Life by David Goodsell. And this is a picture of E. coli, reasonably to scale. The white stuff in here is the DNA. This is a 30,000-fold magnification. If you now look at the black stuff and you magnify that to 100,000, you see that it is dense. It's a very dense, crowded solution. Here is the DNA. These big fellows are called ribosomes. And if you actually add the smaller sugar molecules, it looks a complete mess in here. Inside the nuclear region where you have the DNA is in close contact with many, many proteins. Some proteins are involved with the DNA transcription. Other proteins have to do with the structure, the scaffolding proteins. And third kind of protein reads on the DNA, like RNA polymerase. Those are active proteins. They consume energy. Now, why would it be of interest if you want to model the biophysical properties of DNA? This dense, crowded environment. Well, if you look at the list of the ion concentrations in the cell, it is not 0.1 millimolar with a few divalent ions. Au contraire, inside a cell, for a typical mammalian cell, you have about 150 millimolar of potassium positive ions, but the negative ions ain't there, or rather the small negative ion. The negative ions are proteins. It is chock full of negatively charged proteins. Many of them are polyvalent. This is not millimolar, it is 100 millimolar. Okay? So there's a huge concentration of polyvalent macroions inside the cell. Now, why isn't the DNA not condensing if everybody believes that very small amounts of ions condense DNA? Well, let's look why. This is kind of the picture a biologist would have of DNA inside, let's say, E. coli. Here you have DNA. These are the potassium ions. Then there are lots of negatively charged proteins around. Some of the proteins don't talk to the DNA. Other proteins are bound at specific sites, sometimes called repressor molecules, with a binding energy of perhaps 25 kT. Now, when these repressor molecules are not actually bound to the DNA here, they are not moving freely around. They're spending most of the time, 98%, somewhere else. It's called non-specific binding. And these non-specifically bound proteins have been shown by biochemists to be entirely bound by electrostatics. This is not just electrostatics. You have hydrogen bonding and other forms, hydrophobic interaction. But this non-specific binding, the binding of these proteins to parts of the DNA where it's not directly probing for the base pairs, it's much smaller than 25 kT, about 5 kT, that is purely electrostatics. So here we have the kind of situation which we are supposed to be addressing, where we have DNA and we have highly charged ions. So why is it not condensing? Why is everything staying in solution? Before I'll give you the answer to that, I want to remind you that this, not remind you, tell you that this non-specific electrostatic binding is very important for the functioning of DNA. It's like a parking lot for the DNA binding proteins when they're not active. They can be activated or induced, as biologists say, if there's some environmental switch, some increase in a concentration. Now, the fact that these proteins are not anywhere in the cell, but already on the DNA, increases the switching times. If you have ordinary proteins floating around, and you want to calculate how long it will take to get to a specific site, you do it with the so-called Debye-Smoluchowski theory. If you do experiments on typical repressor proteins, they are about 1,000 to 10,000 times faster than ordinary proteins. And the reason why they don't condense DNA followed from the talk of Barry Honig. Barry Honig mentioned that when proteins bind to DNA, there is a large number of positive charges facing inward, and then there are negative charges facing outward. In fact, typically there are more negative charges than positive charges. So there's still a net repulsion between this protein and the DNA in terms of the monopole interaction. But it is actually much better to think of these proteins as dipoles. They're very large dipoles. The net charge is just about zero, but there's about 12 positive charges on the inner face and 13 negative charges on the outer face. Now, from the viewpoint of design, of proteins, that's a very, very nice type of situation. Because if you have DNA with lots of these type of proteins around, so with positive charges on the inside, but negative charges on the outside, you see that if you have another bit of DNA coming around, it still looks negatively charged. So perhaps there shouldn't be any collapse, even though we have polyvalent ions hanging around there. And this condition would presumably work as long as the typical dipole moment divided by the spacing is large compared to the monopole, which is typically the case for these proteins. So these polyvalent ions are actually having a different nature from the small polyvalent ions which we have been looking at. So I would propose that perhaps rigid polyelectrolytes do not condense if you expose them to large concentrations of dipolar macroions of this kind, because they always keep presenting a negatively charged face to the outside. And I would like to know what is the face behavior if you mix DNA with this type of non-specifically bound proteins or model proteins, which could be micelles, if you could make them in some sort of dipolar form in the spirit of Paul Dubin. And of course, a very interesting question is, are proteins electrostatically designed so that they do bind non-specifically to DNA without triggering collapse of the DNA? Incidentally, although there have been numerical calculations in Poisson-Boltzmann theory of these binding energies, like Barry Honig's done, there is no analytical result which helps us understand what precisely this binding energy should be for a very simple case. There exists a simple theory called the record counter-ion release theory, which says that you should count the number of ions which are facing each other, let it be Z, multiplied by KT and the logarithm of salt concentration. It's based on simple chemical equilibrium arguments, but nobody knows whether that is really right from a more fundamental viewpoint. And I don't see any reason why one couldn't do a good Poisson-Boltzmann calculation for this case. Now back to the dynamics. For the switching of DNA-associating protein, it's very important that they can go as fast as possible to the target site. So here, it would be very nice to know what is this dielectric constant of DNA with condensed counterions. If you move such a protein along the DNA, there are two forms of dissipative loss, hydrodynamic, which has been calculated already, and electrostatic. And that would depend then on the complex dielectric tensor, which depends on K and omega, and which at the moment is not known for DNA, nor even for the simplest possible case of a charged rod with oppositely charged counterions hanging around. If you would know this, then you could treat this perhaps crudely as a point perturbation moving up and down and calculate the dissipative loss and the mobility, and then using Einstein's relation find the one-dimensional diffusion constant. And biologists who are studying the association of proteins with DNA and the switching times are very interested in this one-dimensional diffusion constant. Now, there is one important counterexample of my statement that DNA-associating proteins tend to be dipolar and not monopolar, right? We always focus on monopolar DNA, monopolar objects interacting with DNA, and I'm arguing that the more interesting ones are the dipolar ones. But there's a very important exception, because so far I've been talking how you avoid unwanted DNA condensation, namely by taking dipolar associating objects, but of course DNA does condense in a controlled way during the cell cycle, and that roughly follows this scenario. Here is DNA, and if it condenses, it interacts with a very special kind of protein, the histone, which has been referred to earlier. It's about 100 angstroms in diameter. You can wind the DNA around it. This can be collapsed in an even bigger bundle called the condensed chromatin fiber, and this again can be folded in even larger scale patterns, about 3,000 angstroms large. Now, you can take this fiber with these beads on the string, and I'll tell you later what precisely these beads are, and this step going from here to there, as well as this step going from DNA and putting these beads on, can be mimicked in the lab. Here you see a case of the second step. Here, these are strings of DNA with these beads here being the nucleosomes. What you do there is you increase salt. Increasing salt, of course, screens electrostatics, and then you see much denser bundles which are believed to be the condensed fiber. So that suggests that the control from going from this simple organization to the next level of complexity is controlled by electrostatics. Now, there exists a type of enzyme which can cut the DNA everywhere in between these little objects, these nucleosomes, and you get this famous core particle. Now, this core particle has 1.75 DNA turns, so there's a 1.75 turn of DNA which is associated with a core particle, and there are about 8 histones in here, so an octamer histone unit. This is 110 angstroms. The association of DNA with this object is entirely non-specific. You can take any bit of DNA and it will do this. Now, the electrostatics of this is very interesting because, contrary to the previous examples where you took the typical DNA associating proteins which are dipoles, this is a huge monopole. It has an estimated charge of about 245 E. So the DNA should wind itself around it up until, and it wants presumably to cancel this to make this more or less charge neutral. These are the nucleosome. In this nucleosome, you have there are other histone groups which are on the outside. Is that what you refer in the H ones? Sorry. Say again. The H. You're talking about the H one unit which is on the outside.
No. This histone core is an octamer, right?
Yes.
Okay. Each one of them has a lysine rich tail that just, if you were to draw it, would be outside the DNA. This organelle.
In fact, it is very hard to make that statement because you get these from little crystals which you make of these. So we certainly do not know exactly where these are, but there is no question that there is a net charge on these objects because the charge of the DNA is -292, and if you simply add up the total charge of the histone, whether or not they exactly fit exactly opposite to the DNA or not, the whole thing has a substantial negative charge of 40. And if you now go back to this previous picture, you see that it helps you understand this behavior. If that's right, then these objects have a substantial negative charge, so that by increasing salt, you screen out this repulsion, and you get a condensation simply by in the same way as you have condensation of colloids when you add salt, suggesting that we can use similar types of electrostatic description to understand at least this part of the DNA condensation. I'll come to that. Here it is. You can take these core particles, this is what you probably were referring to, and make a very well, beautifully controlled phase diagram. That was done by von Holde and Jaeger. So you can plot the core particle concentration as a logarithmical salt, and I call this a hydrogen atom of controlled DNA condensation. You find basically three different structures. In the high salt limit, DNA falls off from the octamer. Then there's a kind of first order region. In this regime, at concentration somewhat less than physiological, you have a nice core particle with a 1.7 turn. At even lower salt concentration, where electrostatics becomes very large, the core particle breaks up, presumably because of the repulsion between the positive charges on the histones. So there's a very nice orderly phase diagram, and we don't have a very good theory for that, understanding how this controlled condensation works. So this condensation of DNA is a very important problem. We have a good model system, we have nice experiments, at least to first order, but we don't quite know why it works. Tell me then what you're referring to. In fact, an incredible number of things happen when you duplicate the cell. But what I'm talking about is those cases when, in a controlled manner, you can copy some of these activities in vitro, like, for instance, this experiment which I showed a moment ago. Here, in an in vitro experiment, we seem to be able to copy a key step of the DNA condensation. And it seems to be electrostatic in nature. Of course, in the real cell, surely there are a lot, there's an enormous more activity. You have to organize the chromosome, you have to pull on it with microtubules, I'm well aware of it. But this key step of the condensation, decondensation, seems to be electrostatically controlled, whether you go from the string to the condensed fiber, or whether you see how the DNA is attached to the core particle. Okay? That doesn't require any further activity of enzymes. Enzymes may speed it up, but you don't need it. Yeah, so we have a kind of phase transition. Thank you very much for pointing it out. You have, in essence here, a kind of phase transition which is enzymatically controlled. But it is something which is accessible. Tom is telling me that I should shut up, and I'm going to shut up. The key question now is, why is this a charged object? Why is there such an amount of overcharging of the DNA? You've seen from the talk of Cyril Safinia that DNA lipid association can give you spontaneous charging. Perhaps this is one of the same mechanisms. There are other explanations by Edward Matiescu here in UCSB. UCLA, we worked on a different route. That's not really my point, but I believe that there are a large number of beautiful model systems available for people who want to apply electrostatics to biology and answering questions that, in fact, quite a lot of biologists are very interested in. Thank you.
I'm not sure that I care to stand up and say anything. I will say just a few words, because I've learned a lot from this conference.
No, I didn't mean that.
You're taking the microphone away.
I learned a lot, and I want to compliment the organizers on the very interesting group of people they've brought here over a wide range. I do think that pictures like the last one that we were shown, we should have seen more of in more of the talks. Because I think that everybody realizes there are a number of variables, and it's also clear that biophysics and nature has optimized many of the variables to an enormously high degree. And in as far as there's a scientific underpinning, one thing we need to get at is the degree of robustness of what goes on out there. There's always a special device, and that's what engineers are for. There may be various ways of getting it to do a particular thing. And if it does it, that's fine, and in some sense, it's irrelevant really as to how it does it. But if we're trying to understand a science, and in particular a theoretical science, then one of the things we need to get some larger field for is the robustness. And one of the ways of that is to frankly say there are a lot of variables, and let's see what we can understand by way of the phase diagrams. I will admit that I said a little unkindly to one of our simulators, there are other solvents than water. And nature does these things, I find it fascinating, but if I claim I have an understanding of it, I would be much more impressed by parallel experiments, parallel simulations, that say, well, if I go into quite a different solvent, the same thing happens or it doesn't happen. Some of these things that nature has got to, I think one can convince oneself, have to be pretty close to what when we take them out and do them in vitro, as Robin was talking about, are very close to phase transitions. We don't want to be too frozen, Tom, because then not too much can happen. A crystal is fine for semiconductors, but we know already from the understanding we have of lipid membranes that they have to be pretty close to a number of phase transitions. So there are feedback mechanisms in nature which we, I think, in some sense can't hope to understand at the basic level. But by taking things out, looking at them in vitro, and looking at the phase diagrams, you can also get some understanding. What happens in one small corner of a phase diagram, then I'm very cynical that any calculations, any simulation is going to encompass. If I do a critter simulation, but I get some picture, or I have a theoretical picture, we have some very good overall accounts, I can say, well, I may be in this corner of the phase diagram, I don't know the actual parameters that get me there, that's the detailed chemistry. So I tended to appreciate more the talks and the research that gave us some overall picture from which I could step back on, although we all know that when it actually comes to doing research, you have to focus on some of the details as well. And so that's the sort of the moral I draw away from here. We also know that when you tackle a difficult problem, half the time you don't even know really what all the variables are, and that's even more the case here when it comes to these biological systems. So, personally, I would like to thank the organizers again. I think it's a very interesting group of people they got together. There were a surprising number of actually cross conversations that seemed to be creative and get somewhere. So I'd like to express the gratitude again and to the Institute for hosting.
Well, I think conversation took place during rather than after the summary talks, and so I too would like to thank the speakers, the organizers, Bill, Adrian, and to call for this session and the conference over. Do you have any announcements?
No.
Okay. Exactly. Since we finished this this elaborate multi-course dinner, I invite you to eat up.